You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host. This episode of the podcast is supported by Podcorn. Podcorn has finally launched their services, and take it from me, I've signed up since the beta, and when I started this podcast, there are so many daunting things to worry about. Getting sponsors is something that was heavy on my mind. But now I found a portal that makes it easy. Podcorn is a service that connects brands with podcasters to acquire in-broadcast sponsor time. It's revolutionary in the sense that they give brands the opportunity to be part of the conversation where listeners can hear from the brands. So not just pre, mid, and post-roll host read ads, but brand interviews, panel discussions with experts, and professionals who are within the brand's industry. Look, it's relevant, it's informative, and they're changing the way companies and brands interact. So if you're a podcaster, like myself, I don't care if you're a veteran or a hobbyist or you're just getting started or a brand looking to partner up with one, get started yourself at podcorn.com. They're here to support you at every step and ensure you're protected and compensated for the work that you do for brands. And I mean, that's important, guys. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today.
It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Whoa, you just blew my mind because nobody talks about that shit.
Thank you for this. Like, I was looking forward to this chat, man. I love your interviews.
I thank you for what you're doing. Like, it's excellent. And people can continue to learn the stories of these Bedroom Beethovens.
How did you find out about this? Oh my God.
Having something like this to shed light on us is amazing. Like, we really need this documentation. So people like you are definitely needed.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 46 of the podcast. When I think of the holidays, I think lo-fi. No, seriously. But not to put him in a box, but my next guest is a wizard with the analog machines. Or should I say a doctor? Either way, you get surgical with it. My guest this week.
I go by Dr. Doppler. I make lo-fi music, lo-fi hip-hop, and sometimes stuff that's a little bit more housey than that. And I love hardware.
He has a new project, Flips and Bumps, which is a collection of instrumentals compiled over the last 2 years, arranged more similarly to a live set. And let me slide in that April 6th, 2020 release date. That's Mad Science 2, which is the first anniversary of Mad Science 1. He stays working. Check it out, guys. BedroomBeethovens.com is the website. 5-7 Collective is the gang, and these shows are on all platforms, from Pandora to YouTube to Apple Podcasts, to Stitcher, which nobody really uses. Do you use Stitcher? Good job if you do. And last but not least, Spotify. Just pick one and you're off to the races. And please visit patreon.com/bedroombeethovens to support the show directly so I can keep eating these sandwiches, son. I'm your host, Cello. Let's start the show. Turn your speakers into crackers. It's Doc Dop. I love you, man, but you have the worst name in terms of SEO. Like, if I Googled you, I get the villain in Mega Man, Treasure Island, Clock Stoppers, and a very quirky staff meteorologist in Kerrville, Texas, man.
Yeah. Actually, that's why I don't have the space in my name, which a lot of people add the space just not thinking about it, but there is no space in Dr. Doppler. It's just Dr. Doppler. And actually, if you're trying to play on your Alexa, you have to say that. You have to say Dr. Doppler in order for it to understand what you're trying to do.
I mean, you named yourself that because you kind of saw yourself like as a surgeon.
I went by Doppler for not a long time, but at first. And then in 2011, I want to say, I got an SP555, and then that's when I started chopping shit up. So yeah, the surgery.
It's all about how you see yourself, because I always like to think of it as a chef, like Raekwon, you know, mm-hmm. adding ingredients together until you get a tasty meal.
Yeah.
That's kind of the metaphor I always thought, or like an alchemist.
Yeah.
Tell me where you grew up, because I know you were playing in Somerville, New Jersey a few weeks back, and I actually have family there.
Oh, really? So I grew up in a town called Warren, New Jersey. Not my favorite place in the world. And I lived in Basking Ridge for a little while, which is very close. Greenbrook for a little while, which is very close. And now I live in Somerville, actually. So since July, I've been living
here. And you like it? You like it there?
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. I mean, I'm not a big, we don't really go out to dinner very much. We do, but not me and I live with my girlfriend, and, we don't go out that much, but it's nice to have stuff walking distance. The train's right here. I walk to ShopRite, and, you know, everything's right here.
So oh, I hope domestic life isn't making you soft.
No.
Do you have an inner conflict between your desire for a simple family life and the often reckless desires of your ambition?
No, not really. I mean, I don't really think about it like that. I just kind of do what I do. And my girlfriend Lindsay is very supportive, and she's not pushing me to do anything. So
well, that's good, man. And your father was a musician. Your mom was she was a visual artist, right?
Yes, indeed. Wow. Yeah.
So you had no choice but to be creative. It was a very artsy upbringing.
Yes, that's right. I actually, I have a BFA in art, a Bachelor of Fine Arts. So, you know, took that from my mother and the music from my father.
Did you connect on a music wavelength and then you realized you were also a visual artist, or did it kind of surface at the same time?
Well, I was definitely exposed to both very young. Like my parents would definitely put me in art classes when I was very young and stuff. But I think when I started doing it on my own, like, you know, for my own enjoyment, was really, so it was probably music first. I got a guitar probably in elementary school and immediately started trying to write my own songs and stuff. And then it wasn't really till, well, I got into graph and stuff in middle school. And then by the time I got to high school, I started, like, you know, oil painting and drawing and illustrating, not illustrating, but similar, you know, like, I guess it's illustration work. I would do like little ink drawings on mat board and stuff.
Was being artsy in high school all the rage?
No, not really. Not really.
Well, because your brother, who is, for people that don't know, he's AC Peer. He's kind of more of a singer-songwriter, though. What kind of created that fork in the road where you kind of went one way and then he kind of went the other?
I mean, growing up, we were definitely like always into the same stuff, or I guess it was more I was just into whatever he was into, you know? So for a while, I don't know, like we had always worked together. Like he's a drummer, and like I said, I started with guitar, so we were always jamming. And then my father's a bassist, so again, he could hop in sometimes too, and we would do like little family jams with some of my cousins and stuff. But in terms of my own like singing and songwriting, I guess it just kind of, I don't know, I don't think there was any significant point that I can remember where me and Aaron were like, oh, it's time to break off. But he was living in New York, and then he was in New York City and I was in New York State while I was in college, and he's been living there since he was in college. So, you know, we weren't always together during that period. So obviously we had to do, if we wanted to make music, we had to figure out how to do it on our own, you know?
Well, before he was able to drink legally, he's working with like Lana Del Rey, and later he's working on the set of Spike Lee movies. Was there ever like an urge to call him and be like, bruh, like slide Lana my demo, or tell Spike Lee, you know what Chirac is missing? Some lo-fi. Let's hook it up.
Not really. I don't know. I never really thought about it like that. I just thought it was cool for him, and he's doing his thing. I didn't need to mooch off it, you know? I can make my own path, you know? Sometimes, especially like going to the same schools and stuff, and just being after him in for a long time, or feeling like that, you know? It was, I don't feel the need to mooch off him anymore.
Well, most lo-fi producers, they aren't true lo-fi. They like the sound, you know, and making the anime music videos and the stuff. But you're from the Casio keyboard vinyl landscape. So where did that obsession with analog like begin for you?
It was just the only way I had to do it. You know, like I never had a great computer. It was easier to buy a $200 used Korg KP3, you know, which has the sampler, the little sampler banks in the bottom as well. And that was my first introduction to that. But it was just as simple as that, is that I could afford to buy the little box instead of the, you know, expensive programs and other controllers and stuff.
You had an SP404 at any point?
Yes, I've had most of the SP series for between the Boss and Roland, but yeah, I got a 404 probably, I want to say, 4 years ago.
So I mean there's so much out there, and I'm not really well versed in the equipment, but is any pricey linear sampler worth investing to? Like if I have an SP404, did my production creative skills improve enough to say that having that equipment brought your music to the next level? Like if people are asking you for equipment recommendations, what is your go-to?
I actually do usually recommend the 404, at least to start with. Like I've had a few people, whether it's playing out or, you know, just I've met a few random people and told them that I do this shit. Like, and they're always like, oh, like how do I get into that? How do I start doing that? And I'm like, well, I can't help you out in the software department, but the 404 is definitely a good place to start. And at least if you're sampling, especially records or whatever, and then if you're sampling like your own instruments, like live instruments, then I would definitely go with the 555, which is what I mentioned earlier. It was when I made the change to Dr. Doppler is when I got that. And then at that time, I was using a lot of live instruments. It has phantom power, so you can plug a condenser into it and just sample right into it with a nice mic, you know. So
when you go back and listen to your early albums, what goes through your mind now about what you were doing then? Because to someone like you, you can't really grade your albums as something that gets progressively better, because it's more like you wake up, the stars align, and you find a sample that works, or you had a great month of crate digging.
Usually I guess it's like the production, like how it sounds, you know, like I'll be like, where did I find this sample? You know, I'll still think like that about the old stuff. Like, oh man, I don't even know how I did some of that stuff, but it's usually the production and like the sound of it. And, you know, trying to get, you know, not necessarily super clean, not like overproduced, but something that I'm happy with in terms of how it sounds like sonically. So, yeah, I mean, I do kind of feel that way where each album I am trying to, step it up a little bit, you know. But like you said, with the nature of sampling, it is kind of depends. You just, it's luck almost, you know, it's luck and skill, I guess, equally.
I know. I love your sampling, man. There's a point of view, and I've always believed in, and I've said this on the podcast a few times, that sampling is a way for a different target audience to get in touch with music that they've never heard before. But your sampling, it goes deeper than that. For example, Patrice Rushen, I think Remind Me might be the obvious choice to select for a sample. But during her 4-album run at Elektra in the late 70s and early 80s, Elektra Records really screwed her over. Because they gave her this unparalleled autonomy to write, arrange, and record smart, complicated dance music, and it incorporated R&B, disco, and jazz, and it was performed by large ensembles of LA's leading session musicians. But her labels, they second-guessed, and because they second-guessed her, it guaranteed that their songs were never promoted. Like, you know, can you imagine that your label says that you can do whatever you want, you get excited, and then they're like, you know, we don't like this at all.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and so it's a responsibility, because 40 years later, you're giving these records a second airing. And I think 99% of musicians who record music hope for the music to have an impact on people, and it needs to cut through the noise in such a way that it resonates with another person's truth. So you're giving these people a second wind, and not only do you do a good job, but I believe there is a certain responsibility that comes along with that.
I think anyone who's a crate digger will tell you that finding those those gems, you know, stuff you've never heard of, the most obscure album that, if, you know, could be from anywhere in the world. And whether it's 8-bar loop of it or a whole track or the whole album, like, it's that's what's most exciting about digging, is finding like just that stuff that you would never think to look for.
Really. Yeah, because like, you know, here would be my mindset if I was a crate digger. Like, Donna Summer was big, but then they were just signing copycat acts, which I think hurt the overall landscape too. So instead of people going to Donna Summer, you could sign the fifth copycat act and pick something from there. And I think that's kind of where Patrice Rushen kind of fell into. She was, I don't want to, what do you call it, like, downgrade her legacy, but I feel like she was a copycat act that was signed to mimic Donna Summer's. So yeah. I don't know. It's smart.
Yeah. Forget Me Nots is definitely still bumping on WBLS all the time. So there's at least that. So
Aphex Twin had a really interesting quote. He said that the holy grail for a music fan is to hear music from another planet, which has not been influenced by us or whatsoever, or even better, from lots of different planets. And the closest that we got to that was before the internet, when people didn't know of each other's existence. And now that doesn't really happen. So the adventures of Ray Gun Tony, the mad scientist Doc Dop, seems to be in line with that, where it's outer worldly. Like, I'm going to take you on an adventure.
I honestly think it's just a way for me to get into a creative space, like to have an idea. Like, the idea of making some sort of character for me, it's like, focused enough but also open-ended enough to the point where, like, it gives me direction when I need direction, and then when I have something, I can find a way to, like, make it fit into my narrative. Not necessarily that the Doppler stuff has a narrative, but it has, there's, I am thinking about, like, a scientist in his lab when I'm making the music.
When you're making that music and you're ready to put it out, but then, like, J57's like, well, in the streaming landscape, I got to chop it up for Spotify. Does that take away from the impact? Like, you're not creating your music. Like, this is a minute and 30 second song. This is a minute and 45 second song. Is that messing with your narrative?
No, not really. Actually, I think I posed it as a question, really. I wasn't sold on doing it either way. And I think it worked, you know, and I wish so bad that it was still okay for me to, and it still might happen one day, but, you know, I'm trying to reach as many people as I can right now. And I want to put something out strictly on cassette. But it's just not the time for that. But it's always in the back of my mind. So maybe one day. But still, I wish I was in that era where it was like, yo, it's like, check out my cassette. And there's just something to me about being able to physically hold something, or like having a physical collection. Like, that's really a big part of it to me as well. Whether it's, you know, trying to get my music out there, or making the music and collecting the records and the VHS tapes and the cassettes sometimes, and, you know, being able to hold it is what I need.
Well, also another behavior from people in a different musical generation. I mentioned Aphex Twin. He took 13 years in between projects at some point. What do you think drives people to do that? Like, I've talked with people who say that they have to make music every day or else they feel like their talent isn't being utilized. Maybe he did create music every day and he just didn't put anything out for 4,700 days in a row. Who knows? But what's the psychology around that? I mean, I feel like he could have got away with that in the 90s to the early 2000s. But nowadays, I you're going to be working at Jason's Deli in the meantime. How do you sustain yourself? What's the psychology?
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you what he's thinking, but I don't know if anyone can tell you what he's thinking. I think putting things out consistently is important these days. And at least right now where I'm at, and like I said before, trying to reach as many people as possible, putting out new music and, you know, having new artwork and having a new idea is important. And especially, again, with the nature of sampling, I think it's, I don't want to say easier, but it's just sometimes quicker. And you, at least for myself, I always want to put things out immediately, and I could, but then later on, I'm like, no, it's, I'm glad I didn't put this out then, because now I've worked on this And now it's even better and I have a more cohesive thing. But then I could see myself, like you said, falling into that trap and just doing that over and over and over again. And then who knows how much time has gone by. You know, I could see for myself 4 years going by without putting out music because I keep pushing whatever is coming.
But I mean, some of our favorite artists fall into that trap. And I see that same attitude with Black Moth Super Rainbow, where you talk to him and he says, "I hated Eating Us. It was lame. I scraped the album. And you know what? I'll even go deeper. I never set out to be a musician. I wasn't interested in music as a kid. I just wanted to make what I wasn't hearing." And it's like it's self-deprecating. But at the same time, these artists find success not by a hunger for fame and money. It was just a byproduct of their music. And I suppose that's admirable, but I'm not sure if it's smart.
Yeah, I mean, I think with him, he's just so eccentric and, you know, antisocial. And maybe those are extreme words, but I definitely think the guy, Tom Feck from Black Moth, is a strange fellow for sure. But they are, I'm glad you mentioned them because they are one of my biggest influences for the last over 10 years. They've been always in the back of my mind when I'm making any sort of music. There's a few groups like that.
Those personalities go into hip hop as well. Tell me about your love for Quasimodo.
Oh, I mean, that's a Quas is the turning point of me being like, okay, this is what I want to do now.
Dynamite music, dynamite music.
I got by them trees. You got the trees on me. You got me that killer. Yeah, let me get that purple too. That purple. Man, really don't stop tripping. I ain't got no change. It's my weed right here.
Smoking on the trees at 100 degrees. Never touch the breeze, just a sticky green leaf. Put
it in the dust. And like I said earlier, I was doing like sampling my own, you know, live instruments on the SP-505, and then I probably listened to Quas only, Further Adventures and the Unseen for a year. You know, like that was it all the time. And yeah, that was the point where I was like, you know what, I gotta do this. There's just, you know, Madlib is obviously a genius.
We can't mention Madlib because Quas is different. He was different. Yes. There was nothing like it out there at the time.
That's true, but he still refers to Madlib as the producer of the beats.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. So it wasn't an alter ego or a moniker. It was just like, this is just a different side of it.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a totally different person, I'm pretty sure.
And that's what you felt was special.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And I just loved the sound of it. You know, again, like, it's funny you mentioned that Aphex Twin quote where he's talking about hearing music from aliens, and to me that's almost what Quas was, is because I had never really heard anything like that, you know, with the pitched up voice. And it's like he's saying like super, not all the time, but it's like heavy shit a lot of times, talking about like stabbing people or whatever. And but the voice, you know, with the pitched up voice, it's like so quirky, you know. And it's like so interesting. I love things like that, like where it's like they directly contrast each other, you know, where they're like, they're working together, but they're in opposition directly.
Yeah. I think if you start doing something new, the reason for doing it is because you haven't heard anyone else do it. So if you started doing something new today and it's the first experiment, you get excited because you haven't heard anything like that before. But if you release that on the internet tomorrow, then it would totally put you off continuing that experiment because people would hear it and then they would copy it and it wouldn't be new anymore.
True. Yeah. Or maybe just the idea of having it out there, especially for me, like once I release something, like it's crazy how like, it's so weird. It's like a switch in my brain where like up to the release date, I'm listening to the project like a lot, like almost probably every day. And, you know, whether it's past the final point, you know, doing all the mixing beforehand, but then once everything's submitted, I'll still like listen to it and be like, okay, this is coming. I'm getting ready for it. And it, you know, the day it releases, it's like, okay, time for the next thing. Although Flips and Bumps was a little different because that was more of, I kind of, there was a, I have, you know, I have hundreds of tracks on my computer now. And that was kind of like, if I don't put these things out now and, you know, in this context, then I don't think they're going to come out. And I wanted them to. Some of those beats were 2 years old, you know, and usually I don't work like that. Usually it's like a period of 6 months or 8 months. And then I take from that period and put it out. And then, you know, after that, like I said, the second that's done, it's on to the next one.
So you'll take something to its logical progression on your own, and then you're done with it. And it's like, okay, chuck that out there.
Yeah. And then again, when you mentioned like listening back, it's like because of that and because of like being so focused on the same thing for so long, it's like I'm extra critical when I listen back after it's released. And I'm like, okay, how can I, you know, maybe it's not always taking it to the next step, but just trying to do something a little bit different, you know?
I think you get, doing it that way, you get a more honest reaction to what you've done, and there's no expectation in what people say. But that also changes, though, from like culture to culture. Like in America, it's quite admirable if someone's done well or been successful at whatever it is. But in Britain, they're not. They only like it when you're the underdog. So as soon as you get famous or you blow up, they're like, well, he thinks he's God, that guy. Like Snoop Dogg released a gospel album and it didn't get a tenth of the backlash Kanye got. And there's a reason for that, yeah, you know?
Huh. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why I strive to, I hope that my career can go again, like Tom Fex from Black Moth Super Rainbow. I don't think I'm quite as reclusive, but I just like the idea. It's his label, and he makes all of his own stuff, and he's kind of like riding a weird line. Not necessarily that I think he could be super, super famous, but he's staying just below the surface in the underground, in my opinion. And I think that's a cool spot to be, where you have almost, and he refers to it like this, it's a cult following, and he literally like treats it like a cult sometimes.
I'm pretty sure he's not on stage though performing Hotline Bling and a little black Backstreet Boys though, you know?
Yeah. Wow. How did you get that information?
I want a mansion and a couple bitches to clean up and do some dancing.
Oh, man. All right. Those are not my words, but I did produce the project. Wow.
Well, I know you were just Doppler back in the day. Tell me a little bit about the Hill Tribe demo with Josiah.
We were freshmen in college, and I would blast music from my dorm room, and he lived on my floor. And, you know, I'm not sure whether that was our original meeting point, but he was like, yo, I rap. And like, he showed me some of his stuff, and I was like, all right, let's do this. And, you know, it was very, low tech. I think you could probably tell most of the live instruments and his voice were recorded just from the microphone on my, at that point, probably 6 or 7 year old MacBook. It was definitely a little sketchy, but it was a lot of fun. And, you know, like I said, it was our first year of college, and we could just walk down the hallway and I'd be like, yo, I got something. Or he'd be like, yo, I finished something up. And it was fun. You know, we would just switch back and forth playing Call of Duty or working on the song. Like while he would record, I would play Call of Duty. And then while I edited or whatever, he would play Call of Duty. And it was just a good time. You know, it was a fun, passion project, I feel like, you know.
What equipment did you have in that dorm room? What were you using?
I had my SP-555, the Chaos Pad 3, and my Korg R3 synthesizer and an acoustic guitar. And then, like I said, my crappy MacBook.
That it might be a crappy MacBook, but that Roland, that's expensive.
The R3?
The SP-555.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
There's so much.
I got my R's confused. Yeah. But yeah, that was, actually, so my dad being the musician, he was always very helpful with, you know, purchasing instruments and, you know, he took a lot of interest in things I was doing. He also travels a lot for work. So I still do it sometimes. So he'll check Craigslist, like all these, you know, when he travels places, seeing what people have. And I had mentioned that I was trying to get this piece of equipment, and he found one for like, I think almost like less like 40% of the original price, which was quite nice.
And this was at Alfred University, right?
Yeah. Yep. That's right. I was trying to think of the time period, but yes.
Well, as a freshman, give me some honest feedback. Is lo-fi a young person's game? Because not too many old heads get it. But you know what? The irony is that vaporware is a huge influence, and that embodied components of 80s and 90s nostalgia and aesthetics.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there's people say that what 90s boom bap is now is lo-fi hip-hop. So to say that it's a young kid's game is in my opinion, incorrect, because we're just copying what they did 20 years ago.
My take is different. I felt like New JB's was the trigger of lo-fi, because it wasn't just boom bap. It was trance, new jazz, acid jazz, trip hop, mm-hmm. you name it. And I think a lot of people associate those sounds with Toonami, and then it just kind of grew from there. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's where I always thought it originated from.
I mean, he came up in what, the early 2000s, I want to say. So he's not far off from the golden era, the 90s, you know.
Him and Psych Origami and a few other people, Dilla.
Yeah, of course, Dilla. Can't not mention Dilla, right?
And you're patient. You'll wait for something to catch your ear. You won't force it. So, you know, if you have any other projects, you know, what's ahead, you know, what's been sitting on your hard drive for a couple of years, you know, I'll give you the floor to kind of dive into that.
Since Mad Science, the first one, came out, I've been working towards Mad Science 2. Right now, that's my big focus. I've also been working on a... We've only done a few little things, but one of my good friends growing up, who was also very much influenced by Black Moth Super Rainbow, me and him kind of want to start a, I don't want to say a copycat project, but more like a tribute to Black Moth Super Rainbow, at least the early stuff. So that's coming up. And then actually J57 hit me with a bunch of stems, and hopefully we're going to try to get a little collaborative EP or album going, hopefully soon. But yeah, I've been chipping away at all three of those. So we'll see what how it all plays out. I'm aiming for April 6th again, which would be exactly 1 year after Mad Science 1 for Mad Science 2. So we'll see.
You remember Eddie Auer?
Yes, I do. That I've also been keeping on the back burner for the Eddie Auer 2.0, but we'll see how that goes as well.
My pitch is you do a podcast with your brother and call it Peer to Peer.
Okay, there you go. I feel like, that's funny. Actually, my mom made me a Halloween costume when I was a little kid as a boxer, and on my robe it said the Peerless Peer.
I like it. Yes. Mom and dad jokes everywhere.
And the peer puns as well.
Yeah. Well, man, I'm excited, man. We're label mates. 5-7 Collective, man.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Thanks for being here. And this hopefully this is the last time that we talk and collaborate. And I'm hyped, man. I'm hyped for you, man. I think you're super talented.
Thank you.
And man, thanks for being here.
Yeah, dude. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.